2 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session number 162, Murder Most Mormon, featuring Conspiring to Commit, The Whodunit of Mormon Crime Fiction, a paper presented by Paul M. Edwards, and The Angel Acronym, A Philosophic Murder, a paper presented by Lavina Fielding Anderson.
Okay. Well, we are at session 162, Murder Most Mormon. So if you find that you're in the wrong place, then stay anyway because it's going to be great. We actually have a little bit of a unique situation. We don't have a paper then a respondent. We have two papers. The first will actually be reversed in the program. Lavina will speak on the Angel Acronym. And then Paul will do Conspiring to Commit. One of the perks, I suppose, of being the symposium coordinator, as I mentioned to another session, is I can schedule myself where I like. And I put myself here because I was just fast. I just thought this was probably just the funnest paper all year that we had proposed, and I was so excited. I, of course, have enjoyed mysteries myself, and I remember I read Sherlock Holmes, and I started, of course, with Study in Scarlet. And I started with Study in Scarlet not knowing what the story was. And so I'm reading about these guys in Mormon, Utah in the 19th century and just loving it and shocked that he was talking about it. And very much enjoyed Arthur Conan Doyle's yarn and read the rest of them. Well, why don't we go on to introducing our speakers? And I apologize if I'm I ripped open my chair packet and there was nothing in it. it was empty. So we don't have bios for them, but I'll wing it and they can correct me if they'd like. Lavina, of course, probably doesn't need much of an introduction. She's a longtime Sunstoner supporter, just a wonderful human being. And author of Lucy's book, which, for a brief editorial, I think deserved Best Book Award and not Best Documentary Award, but that's just me. I loved that book and just fascinated by it.
Best Book Award from John Hooker.
Oh, there you go. Great, great. All right. That makes me feel better. And I'm really looking forward to her comments. I did not know that Lavina was a mystery aficionado, so I'm really looking forward to her comments. Paul Edwards has written a book. When's it coming out, Tom?
January.
The Angel Acronym, which is a trilogy. It's going to be a trilogy about Tomb Taggart, right?
We hope it's a trilogy.
Okay. hope it's a trilogy. That'd be great. Will be the first of hopefully a trilogy of a series on Tomb Taggart, a detective. And well, yeah, of course. Paul is an archivist in Missouri, and I think you don't want to hear me, so let's listen to them. Lavina.
Let me begin with my favorite quotation about murder mysteries. It comes appropriately enough from a character in a mystery who explains why she prefers crime fiction to romance. Quote, "There are more ways to commit murder than there are to have sex, and that makes murder more interesting." While I would not presume to comment either on Paul Edwards' sex life, nor on his sinister affinity for crime, I may speculate that he is uniquely qualified to write Mormon crime fiction by his academic training in philosophy, his prolonged paddling in the troubled waters of Mormon history, his skill in navigating academic politics at Graceland College, and his entirely suspicious expertise as a long-term bureaucrat at the world headquarters of the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, now Community of Christ. I find it entirely logical that he retired as head of the RLDS Church's Temple School and turned immediately to a life of crime. In fact, he achieved the dazzling status as yet beyond the aspiration of any other Sunstone participant of whom I am aware, of having the current president of his church denounce him as motivated by sour grapes because he didn't become president. Although Paul's resume shows more than 41 books and articles, most of them are in history, historiography, doctrine and theology, and philosophy. One of my favorites is a collection of personal essays evoking the spirit of place. I also know that he writes poetry and has written at least 2 unpublished novels, not to mention 2 more co-authored and published with his son Greg. But his first venture into crime, the Angel acronym, is a new departure. I've spent the summer enjoying Volume 2 in this series, and since Paul gets his best ideas mowing the lawn on Saturdays and attending church on Sundays, from a literary perspective, though not a personal one, I can only regard with dismay his willingness to upset this fruitful weekend schedule by appearing in person at Sunstone. Michael Austin has done the most thorough work and compiled the most extensive bibliography, showing that an increasing number of Mormon characters, Mormon settings, and Mormon writers are participating in the steady popularity of this nationally significant genre. He notes that Mormons have traditionally made their literary debuts in bad literature, sensational, cliché-ridden, and disreputable. By his count, over 50 adventure and romance novels featuring violent, conspiratorial Mormon stereotypes appeared between 1850 and 1900, followed by nearly 50 more such novels, along with more than 2 dozen silent movies which were released between 1900 and 1920. Probably everyone here has read Arthur Conan Doyle's first Sherlock Holmes mystery, A Study in Scarlet, published in 1887, in which Mormons certainly play that role. Interestingly enough, the year before this work, Doyle wrote a play titled The Dark Angels, never finished, in which he tried out the Danite plot and gave a role to Dr. John Watson in San Francisco. Sherlock Holmes does not appear. This play was just published by the Baker Street Irregulars with excellent accompanying essays, including one by R. Michael Homer on the Mormon subplot. The Journal of Mormon History has a notice about this book in its forthcoming fall issue. The core of Michael Austin's bibliography is books published between 1979 and 1998. He selected this beginning date because a series of real-life events prompted renewed interest in Mormons as negative and sensational in ways that reminded the country of all of the 19th century anti-Mormon stereotypes that had been bouncing around in the country's collective memory for 100 years. These stories include the execution of Gary Gilmore, the excommunication of Sonia Johnson, the shooting of John Singer, the LeBaron murders, the Lafferty murders, the Mark Hoffman forgeries, the standoff with polygamous leader Adam Swap, and the human sacrifice killings associated with Jeffrey Lundgren's Kirtland-based RLDS schism. There are 80-plus books in his bibliography also meet 2 other criteria. They deal in a substantial way with Mormonism, and they are marketed primarily for a non-Mormon audience. Austin makes an exception for 2 mysteries published by Signature, and I think he will definitely include Paul's series. Mike's analysis focuses on 3 19th century themes refurbished for the 20th century: the Mormon conspiracy, the blood atonement murder, and the hostage maiden. I think it may be possible to argue that Paul's first mystery draws on but significantly transforms the first 2 themes in philosophically and theologically interesting ways. I won't, in fact, make that argument because I don't want to give away the plot, but I hope to revisit this topic after publication. Let's look more specifically at Paul Edwards' contribution to this stream of spilled Mormon blood. The Angel acronym is the first in a series featuring philosopher bureaucrat Toom Taggart, a not very thinly disguised version of Edwards himself, who arrives at work one morning to find that one of his employees, the church archivist, has died in an odd accident while examining a document written by Paul's real-life controversial grandfather in a successful effort in the 1930s to seize supreme directional control of the church. With the assistance of the church's brainy lady lawyer, Marie, he digs deeper, fighting bureaucratic witlessness on one hand and discussing serious philosophical questions with the First Presidency's expediter, gopher, and maybe hitman, Rockwell Porterfield, on the other. I might add that Tom Kimball, the signature publicist, thought this name was too obvious. Who's this character now? Well, I'm still calling him Rockwell Porterfield. Since the first corpse in this novel is the Community of Christ archivist, those of you who know and love the real archivist, Ron Nernig, will be greatly relieved to know that he is alive and swell. And with exquisite tact, he promised me that he would be attending another session during this hour, but here he is. Those who have visited Community of Christ sites in Independence or done research in its fine library archives will enjoy the fact that the murder is set in the striking shell-shaped Community of Christ temple and its associated offices. The setting is one of the strengths of these novels. Another is Taggart himself. He is married but childless, and his wife is institutionalized in a nearby town with a condition never fully specified, but which leaves her only intermittently coherent and responsive. Taggart's reticence about her condition, his suffering for her and because of her on his weekly visits, and the marital limbo that ensues adds an interesting dimension to his character. It also enables Edwards to balance his lonely protagonist on the very thin knife edge between platonic friendship for and erotic attraction to Marie, both elements of which she reciprocates on at least some level, and the essential restraint expected of two employees of a conservative religious organization. Paul complicates this relationship by developing a romance between Marie and the detective investigating the murder, thus creating a truly subtle and emotionally fraught triangle of desire and constraint. A third appealing element is the plot. I read a lot of crime fiction. In fact, I read more mysteries than I do Mormon history, and someday someone is going to figure out that I read them both for the same reason, and the jig will be up. But my point is that there's a lot of plot recycling that goes on in crime fiction, so it's unusual to find a genuinely ingenious plot. In a word, I encounter a lot of truly stupid plots in my reading, so I have only the greatest admiration for Paul's research in documenting a mechanism of death that is not only dazzlingly creative, but absolutely plausible as well as possible. A fourth genuine contribution to the genre of Mormon mysteries is the philosophical element. Toon Taggart has conversations with Marie about the generational identity crisis and some very interesting discussions with Rockwell Porterfield on the uses of history, the nature of evil, the difference between belief and faith, and the paradoxes of obedience. Here's a snippet. Toon asks Rock, "Is there anything they'd tell you to do that you wouldn't do?" Porterfield did not hesitate even for a second. "No, but I know, and you should too, that they would never ask me to do anything that was not right." "So if they say it, it's right?" "No, Taggart," Porter said, as if explaining to a small child. "That's not it. It's just the opposite of. They wouldn't ask it if it weren't right. There's a considerable difference between those two positions." "Yes, you're right about that, but this assumption predisposes you to think that everything they ask is right?" "Since they are," the flat voice went on, "I'm not too worried about it." "Would you kill someone?" Toon asked, surprising himself. "You're being asinine. What sort of a question is that?" "Humor me. I'm a philosopher." "Well, no, I wouldn't kill anyone, and the reason I wouldn't is that they wouldn't ask me to do that." We have had whole Sunstone sessions on this topic, and its philosophical and theological implications are woven throughout the fabric of this novel. But I have to say that what I adore above all else in this mystery is the office politics, which forms a kind of hilarious subplot to the serious business of murder. I want to read just two scenes to you. The first occurs when Toon comes to work right after Labor Day and has to pick his way through a tangle of Christmas tree lights spread out on the floor of the foyer. Toon stared at them in disbelief. Only four purple and gold bulbs were going into the tiny sockets. "What is this?" he demanded. "It's the decorations," beamed Marva as Saul staggered backwards out of a closet. He was carrying a huge cardboard box labeled Star. "I can see its decorations," said Toon patiently. "I can even tell that they're Christmas decorations, in spite of the fact that Labor Day was exactly 48 hours ago. What I don't understand is why you're doing them now and why you chose those colors." Barney started, "We're just checking to be sure that..." But Laura snapped, "What's wrong with these colors?" "Well, nothing, I suppose," Toon said, "except that they're awful, Laura. This is all that's left." "Left from what, a garage sale?" "No, it was Barney. Left to use." "Meaning?" "It's real simple. Even a philosopher can understand it." Barney was starting to get mean now. "Try me. My orders are not to use the same colored lights this year as the Utah cousins next door. Well, I checked, and between the visitor center and the meeting house, they're using red, green, white, blue, and blinking yellow. All that leaves me is purple and gold." "And why can't we use the same colors as the Mormons?" Laura sighed. "The reason is that this is a decision. If you want a reason that makes sense, go somewhere else." "Why do we have to put up lights at all?" Toon demanded. "See previous answer," Laura droned. "They're not all that bad," announced Laura, Ashley judiciously. "It might be a little difficult decorating around these colors in the bookstore display, but purple and gold would be perfect. It would really make your book the centerpiece of the Christmas display." Saul held up an already lighted string, the purple and gold lights reflecting weirdly off his white shirt and teeth. "Merry Christmas," said to him. The book Ashley mentions is one on the role of angels that the presiding bishop has assigned Toon to write for totally obscure reasons. The scene in which he gets this assignment is one of my favorites. The third note said, "You have an appointment to see Bishop Pico at 12:45. Toon groaned, but had enough energy to be mildly curious. He took the elevator to the top floor. Toon basically did not like ascending to the rarefied heights where the great man worked. It was an attitude thing, and most of the attitude was his. "Hello, Yonusu," he greeted the secretary, a severely gray-clad woman with stunningly disciplined iron-gray sausage curls. She covered the telephone receiver and said, "Go right on in, Toon. Bishop Pico has been waiting for you." She managed to make it sound like a rebuke, even though Toon was 3 minutes early. Toon found Lowell Pico, the church's chief financial officer, quite interesting. In a world where he was surrounded by boring bureaucrats, this meant that Toon was actually grateful to the man in a strange sort of way. Pico was, again in a strange way, one of Toon's many bosses. The new language of teams and communities of joy and win-win planning meant that it was very confusing to know who was actually in charge until it was too late. Fortunately, Toon had never supposed that someone who didn't control the money had any real authority compared to those who did control the money, so he and Pico had always gotten along fine. Pico was sitting behind his rosewood desk, his computer displaying a spreadsheet that, as he spun around, turned into tropical fish slithering through improbably blue depths. On his desk, between a set of praying hands bookends, were the church's three standard scriptures. Toon noticed that the titles were facing outward, toward the visitor. "Tom," Pico said, standing and extending his hand. This is one of Pico's characteristics. He always mispronounces Toon's name. "So good of you to come up. I know how busy you must be." It was his standard opening. "Never too busy to talk with you, Bishop," Toon replied, his voice a well-practiced balance between deference and the hint that it really had been a great sacrifice. Pico came out from behind the desk and ushered him into one of the three easy chairs that formed a conversation corner at the end of the office. On the coffee table before them were three green files in the August issue of the Saints Herald, on which was pictured a clutch of beaming blonde children and a politically correct token black moppet holding a Jesus banner. The bishop took the second chair. "Tom," he said again, his voice deepening to convey seriousness. "Tom, we need your help." Toon restrained an impulse to match Pico's forward tilt. That voice always meant that some sort of pronouncement was about to be made, so Toon was curious. It also meant that he was about to be handed a job he couldn't pass on, so Toon also felt dread. "What can I help you with?" Tom asked. If he gave you the barest stress, Bishop Pico did not seem to notice. "Angels, Tom," intoned Bishop Pico. "We need help with angels." He leaned forward and picked up the green folders. "I thought angels were supposed to help us," Tom queried, keeping his smile pleasant rather than humorous. Well, yes, Tom. Yes, I guess that's true. The bishop leaned back in his chair and crossed his legs. He was wearing executive-length navy blue socks. He produced yet another level of seriousness. But you understand, what I need is to talk with you about writing a book about angels. A book? A book about angels? Toon felt that he was babbling idiot repetitions. He was. Tom, Bishop Pico said impressively, we feel that there is a need for our people to have something which would suggest that the church, that is, the brethren, have not given up on angels. And have you? Toon asked. Of course not, Tom. Of course not. And you believe a book will help accomplish this? Yes, Tom. Yes, we do. Pico tapped the three folders on his knee meaningfully. It is the Aaronic Priesthood Quorum, he said. You know, of course, that the bishops are responsible for the training of the Aaronic Priesthood Quorum. We feel some serious obligation to be of assistance to this group of fine, dedicated men. And women, Toon reminded him. And women, yes, Tom, Pico recovered smoothly. Young men and women, fine young men and women, yes. They seem to feel that we have not followed up on these keys of the kingdom business. You are aware that, in our belief, it is the Aaronic Quorum that holds the keys to the ministry of angels? Yes, I'm aware of that. Well, Tom, this is where you come in. There is some feeling that the church does not give proper attention to the role of angelic ministry. Several of the quorum, that is, the Aaronic Quorum, have tried writing something down. We are not well pleased with what they have done. Not that it is wrong, but it just does not say what we think should be said. You may want to look at these later. He handed Toon the green folders. You want me to rewrite this material? Toon felt a familiar clutch in his stomach. No, Tom, the bishopric thinks it would be best if you put together a book of your own about the ministry of the Aaronic Priesthood. The book might well include several things, but particularly about the ministry of angels. And you want me to write this? Yes. Yes, Toon, we do. We think it would be a very practical solution to our problem. He stood up, walked to his acreage of window, then turned and looked at Toon as if waiting for the Red Sea to part. Toon tries to wriggle out of it by saying he doesn't have time, then by announcing that he doesn't believe in angels. Bishop Pico was having none of it. You don't have to believe in everything you write about, do you? That is what writers do, isn't it? Toon had to admit that this was indeed what some writers did, but not usually those employed by religious organizations to explain theological concepts. So Toon thinks he has refused to write this book, but meanwhile it appears on planning schedules, publicity promotions, and, as we have seen, color schemes for the bookstore display. His contribution to the project is to fasten a memo about it to his bulletin board with a spiral of bicolored pushpins that begins at the center and covers the whole page. Fortunately, Janet, his sarcastic and competent secretary, orders up printouts from the library of everything on CD about angels, much of it from LDS Works that sounds suspiciously like Bruce R. McConkie. A few weeks later, Toon drags himself to work, terminally depressed because the rough draft of that pestilential angel book was due to the Resource Committee and Aaronic Priesthood Commission. Janet had circled the date in a lurid day-glow purple with an interior circle of day-glow orange. It had taken strenuous personal discipline to train himself to ignore that side of the room. The telephone rang and he picked it up. Lulu Sue said, "Hold on for Bishop Pico." Before he had drawn a sufficiently deep breath, the good bishop was intoning, "Tom, yes, Tom, what can I say? Magnificent, simply magnificent. You're too modest in saying it's a rough draft. It displays the kind of mature spirituality, the searching, I may say the penetrating, theological examination that will answer any possible questions about whether we as a movement take angels seriously. And those stories, the human touch, Tom, I usually leave prophecy to the prophet, but I freely predict that this book will become an instant classic quoted from the World Conference to the Sunday School class." Toon had stopped inhaling at some point. He said faintly, "Thank you, sir." Bishop Pico chuckled and said, "A real team player, Toon, that's what you are." The line clicked. Toon hung up and strode out to Janet's desk. "So, how did you do it?" he asked. She explained modestly, "Oh, it was simple. The stuff that the Aaronic Quorum had done was really pretty good, so I just used their manuscript as an outline and stuffed each topic with scriptures and stories and sermons until it was 230 pages long. With the computer, it practically wrote itself." Toon raised his eyebrow. "Do you think the Aaronic Quorum is going to mind when they see that I've plagiarized their stuff?" "Of course not," she said indignantly. "They know they're the wrong level to be making major doctrinal statements. The only way they get in print is if somebody with some clout said it first. That's you. Besides, I got the name of anybody who even breathed in the same room with that manuscript and put them all in the acknowledgments. That's after I sent emails from you thanking them for their contributions as made available to you by Bishop Pico." They were ecstatic. He thought about it for a minute. He couldn't think of a loose end in the whole arrangement. "So now I know how you did it," he said. "Why did you do it?" She sighed. "Toon Taggart, has it ever occurred to you that if you got fired, I'd have to work for a living?" "It probably says something about me that I find utterly irresistible these slices of life in a large religious corporation. I know that Paul has volume 3 and 4 outlined, but I'm trying to get him to set volume 5 at Graceland, where we can get church and academic politics combined, and I'll be glad to supply Paul's email address to anyone who wants to add his or her lobbying voice to mine." It is a little known fact that the M in Paul M. Edwards stands for Moriarty, the Napoleon of crime. And now it's his turn. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm not sure if I can tell you what the difference is, but I sense that there is a difference between being a murderer and being a killer. So began Toon Taggart's efforts to explain murder to his friend Marie in Murder by Ties, the third in the mystery murder series to be published, we hope, by Signature Press. In this violent world, it appears to be necessary that there are some men and women who, placed in harm's way, become killers. The essence of this social necessity means that there are persons all around us who have killed other people. But few of these, thankfully, are murderers. It was in trying to understand this somewhat subtle distinction that I first began to consider the difference between the concept of intent and expectation. The mystery writer Lawrence Block once explained that writers get ideas the way oysters get pearls. This appears to me to be the manner in which the idea of a murder mystery came to me one hot August afternoon following my attendance at a mandatory 5-day conference on visioning. Several times during the week I had considered murdering one or more of my colleagues. Such frail thoughts do not linger long, however, and it was not until later that when I was mowing the lawn and in retrospect began to wonder if I had taken such a step, that is, murder of my colleagues, could any jury of my peers find me guilty? My complaint is of no importance here other than its potential justification for murder. But the point, of course, is that I considered murder, but I did not, and for the record, would not, commit such a deed. I was not going to murder those persons, despite the fact that they deserved it. But I wondered, might there be any situation in which one might find themselves, I might find myself, as justification for murder? And the answer, unfortunately, was yes. Thus, as promised in the abstract, I will make a brief comment on this consideration and then want to close with a short confession. The followers of Joseph Smith are no strangers to violence. Over the years, we have dealt with murders of passion and greed and confused theology, and I suspect, though I cannot prove, some murders of institutional existence or fear of benign neglect. Yet it does not seem reasonable to me that the decision to murder someone would result from a reaction to an already established theological issue. Few persons understand such things, and fewer still treat them seriously. Rare also would be a murder to right some insult against which the body of the church had suffered. The larger church has suffered many such insults over the years, and in my opinion has dealt with them with inimitable restraint and calmness. Rather, I believe an act of murder would be an extreme reaction to an equally extreme threat. And probably the issue involved will be little other than the extreme interpretation of an issue or issues that dealt with things we deal with most commonly in everyday life. I do not believe the crime of boredom, the one I was thinking about, requires punishment by blood atonement. But murder might be the result of a passionate fear of spiritual loss or the need to defend something key to the soul of the believer. It is not too difficult to anticipate what some of these areas of concern might be. The most basic, I thought, would be the issue of historicity, and thus I started there. And that's the plot of the first murder. Others identified later during other afternoons spent with the lawnmower became plots for the rest of the series. I envisioned the murder, like their causes, would be clear and simple. It was important that the murderer not be a bad person, but rather a believing human being whose fault was a passionate but misdirected commitment. The persons I fear are not the mean-spirited fellow travelers who occupy places of importance in our lives. Rather, I fear the sweet, narrow-minded individual who is prone to letting single issues become obsessions. I fear the person who, in seeking to be good, is incapable of understanding the degree to which that which they seek to make prejudice into law. The person identified as the murderer in the angel acronym, the first of these, represents a kind of person we all know, a basically good person for whom the justification for murder would, in their context, also be seen as good. The hero, defined as Tatum Taggart, needs to be smart and clever, but he must not be arrogant. He must also suffer from some of the same flaws as the villain. That is, he must be easily identified with his own passions. To make it easier, I gave him much of the same background as my own, but taking advantage of fiction, I was able to make him nicer and smarter and younger and thinner. I considered the environment created by the RLDS, now Community of Christ, as a field ripe for such a murder and ready for the harvest. After 60 years a member and more than 4 decades in professional association with its institutions, I am both knowledgeable and frustrated by the movement. The body of the church is identified with its passions or lack of them, and the good and evil it does is often confused by the paradoxical structure of the goals, process, and missions of the church. I see it as a perfect environment in which to picture humanity's expectations and follies. The more one is committed to the articulation of the movement, the easier it is to be dissatisfied with its lesser goals. Mere involvement identifies a passion of sort, but as acceptance becomes standard, it is important to acknowledge that love without passion is no love at all. As the body becomes standardized, those who are deeply committed are inclined to challenge the fear of the development of standardization by commitment and deep and extreme passion. A deep and extreme passion which one acknowledges and which often ends up projecting the mundane as the magnificent. Despite what I have said so far, no actual persons are represented in the characters of my book. This is not only to protect individuals from what might be seen as criticism, but because there are no persons within the headquarters structure that I know who possess the extremes I want to portray. I am very fond of Church Archivist Rob Lomick, and only reluctantly kill him off. Not totally reluctantly, sort of reluctantly kill him off. Yeah. But having said this, the characteristics of leadership within the community of Christ provide a representation both of the humanity and of the divinity of the calling. The fatal flaw in this circumstances is found in the paradox of leadership inherent in the organization. Those in leadership, in headquarters and in congregation, or wards, are torn between their calling as ministers and their assignments as managers. Despite Stephen Covey's naive optimism, they will never be involved in a win-win situation. And under a lot of circumstances, the variance of this is the source of many of the ills of the movement. It is a conflict between order and compassion. Let me illustrate from a brief passage from A Murder by Ties. "So what can I do for you?" he asked. "What do you want to talk to me about?" The congregational pastor was an honest man who took his responsibilities very seriously. "I'm afraid I've made some rather unwise decisions lately," Ida said. "Some things I want to reconsider." "Yes," the older man said. "Yes, how can I help?" "Well," Ida was determined to express herself clearly, "there is this man here at work. He and I..." Hold it, pastor said. "Does this have anything to do with sex?" "Well, yes, in a way," Ida said. Hold it. "I need to warn you, Ida, that as pastor, I will need to take some action if you have broken the laws of the church." "I thought I could talk to my pastor freely," was the statement. "Oh, yes. Yes, you can," he replied. "It's just that as pastor, I have to report your indiscretions and the laws that you've broken." In any conflict, the primary commitment of the organization seems to loom largest and most easily justified. Given a serious challenge to life or the value of the movement, the value of a single person is often sacrificed for the larger need of the community. A fellow traveler of this difficulty is the inherent confusion between having authority and being authority. In the community of Christ, some of these persons are actually called general authorities, close quote. The transfer of authority from spiritual calling to technical decisions makes looms large and is the source of considerable institutional confusion and, I suspect, mediocrity. From my perspective, members of the Mormon persuasion take things very seriously, too seriously. And some members take some things so seriously that they cannot be considered at all. This seems to me to be counterproductive. Faith without doubt is no faith at all. Thus, I have tried my hand at suggesting a less serious look and have, over the years, been less than successful. The mysteries I've concluded might make it possible to raise some of these same serious topics by presenting them in a manner where they would not be seen as a threat. After all, it's only a murder mystery. Perhaps I could use this genre to suggest just how ludicrous some ideas become when they are left unconsidered. Let me illustrate this with a passage from the second volume of the series, Murdered by Sacrament. Is a part of a conversion between Toon and the Community of Christ theologian with the very appropriate name of Michael Coors. Coors accused Tom of has accused Toon of desecrating the communion. "What did you do?" Michael Coors asked. "I flushed it down the toilet," Toon said. "Why would you do that?" "It gets there eventually." Michael Coors was not amused. "The communion?" "No," Toom said, and then he thought it sounded defensive. "The bread and the grape juice, the leftover. It was just leftover food. But it was communion." No, Mike, it wasn't. It had been communion early in the morning. It might even be communion later in the afternoon. But right then, it was leftover food. By the time I flushed it down the toilet, it was leftovers. The communion is supposed to be disposed of with dignity. You mean like the garbage disposal? Well, you're trying to make it sound as if it was not serious. It is serious. It is serious to some folks. But not because what I did was wrong, but because you and a lot of other people make a problem out of it. Well, I wanted to hear your side of the story. Don't you think this tells us more about you than it does about me? You don't agree, do you? You don't think that what I did was a desecration of the communion. Well, I suppose not. But there is a thin line between the idea of sacrament as mystical participation and the communion as a symbolic reenactment. When you make such a thing unfeeling, an insensitive move as you made, it seems to betray the spiritual side of it, the mystical side. Mike Toon said, I think you're confusing the symbol with what it symbolizes. Right, it is a symbol, but it must be treated as that which it symbolizes, says Mike. Well, that's it seemed to me, said Toon. There are symbols, and so are symbols that have no value at all. In and of themselves, they are nothing. If that is what we believe, then it doesn't matter what happens to the symbols as long as they remain symbols. When they become more than symbols, they deserve respect. I'm not sure, Michael said. It's just not the same. At the conclusion, the brief confession here is in order. I don't want you to think that my efforts were all altruistic. To a very large extent, I wrote these mysteries because I wanted to. Let's call it therapy. My experience in writing nonfiction is that few persons read what I have written and fewer still agree with it. Writing fiction which someone might just possibly read and that no one will take seriously has been food for my soul. Besides that, fiction gives me an opportunity to comment on almost anything that aggravates or excites me without a lot of supporting arguments and elaborate footnotes. Take this brief exchange between Toon and his friend Marie concerning the names of students in one of his classes. It's a small class, but in this class I have a girl called April Love, one called September Morn, two who answer the name Solomon, and a wide assortment of Tricia's, Trickett's, Wendy's, and the one called Morlanda. Oh, said Marie. There's more. I have a girl named Thomas, and a burly, heavy-set young man who answers to the name Delilah. Come on, she said, this is too much. He raised his hand as a witness taking an oath. Verily, I say unto you, thinking about this, I have come to a conclusion, what I need to share with you, that each new generation seeks an ever stranger means of identifying its young. The future is in commercials. In commercials, Marie, yes, as this generation gets more conservative and institutional-minded, and the bewildered parents look for something better than the cute names of late 70s and 80s, they are moving away from Barbie doll and movie star names. Just like the non-pious folks, in a nostalgic and defiant appropriation of religion, revived Quaker and Pilgrim names a generation ago. Chastity, Joshua, Sarah, yes. So my conclusion is that the truly modern person will turn to modern religion. In other words, commercials. I'm thinking of Static Cling, or Downy Soft for the girls, and Pop-Tart, or Automax, and I had, but she took out, Trojans for the boys. And for the parents who prefer not to differentiate between genders at all, the simple fruit of the womb might suffice. It would be unfair to suggest that I engage in this activity in hope of social revision or organizational change. That is giving my intentions and expectations far too much credit. But there is some truth in the idea that I recognize the value of fiction in trying to articulate philosophical ideas that are hard to express because of the baggage they carry. I have made the attempt to use the mysteries to express concerns and beliefs while at the same time hoping to tell an interesting story and amuse the reader. The writing of them has been a highly successful venture for me. Only time and the readers will tell if it is true for them. Thank you.
Fifteen or 20 minutes. If there's any questions, if you'd like to come up and say it in the microphone so it gets on tape, that would be great. Or I can repeat it back, or one of these two can. Oh, great.
In terms of religious ideas that people are willing to kill over, I think you have been quoted as saying that you think there are about 10. Do you want to specify those?
Well, I don't know how many of you are used to Missouri weather, but when it's 105 degrees out and the sun's out and you're trying to mow the lawn, weird things happen to you, hallucinatory things. And as I was considering this, I, the historicity was easy. I thought that was, everybody's worried about that.
My cousin probably got killed over it, right?
Yeah, Ron got killed over it, or somebody like Ron got killed over it. The question I had then, of course, was what issues are significant enough to make people angry enough or frightened enough to move beyond the constraints of discipline? And I think that I see those in those issues about which people become passionate. I understand their passion. In some ways, I even envy their passion. I just am afraid of how quickly the world experience that passion moves into some kinds of acts which are not acceptable by the rest of us. It seems to me that some aspects of the ordinance, certainly sacrament, which is the topic of the second book, the whole question about what happens to the sacrament, what does it mean between LDS and RLDS tradition as against, say, Baptist or Methodist tradition. But more important, what use or misuse of it might drive someone to take an action they thought was necessary to fix it or to change it. I think the same thing is true of tithes, even though after I began writing this, I had got kind of thrown kind of a curveball, because my denomination suddenly, after 100 zillion years, decides to re-identify what tithing is, and I don't even like their new definition, but I didn't like the old one, and so it was a good source of this. I think ordination is one, at least for us, because the whole question of the ordination of women and being a more, I don't say democratic, but I don't mean democratic in the sense of listening to people. I mean democratic in a really formal sense. Being more democratic, we have a great deal of difficulty with things like silencing. I mean, how do you silence somebody that's been called to the priesthood, because that's an act of God? So how does the church do that? Well, we have ways of coming around that. You know, we get around it so we can do it. But for some people, those are very, very, very passionate issues. There are 10 of those that I found, and I could have been 12 or 15, and nobody's promised to publish more than one, so whether they ever get written, I don't know. I write them for me. I enjoy writing them, so we'll see. Long answer.
Unless there's a question out there, I'm curious as to, from the two of you, why do you think Mormons can fit so well into some of these detective or mystery fictions? Is it just that it's a unique group, or do they fit in well? What's the approach, particularly that negative approach, or you know, what's the reasoning behind putting them in this sort of fiction?
Well, I think that in contemporary crime fiction, Mormons are playing more of a of a background role as part of the local color. If you look at Lee Martin's mysteries, for instance, the protagonist is a female police detective whose son, a teenage son, converts to Mormonism, and so it's one more hassle. She's got to work his getting him to seminary into her already overloaded schedule. And the last one that I read by her, they come to Salt Lake, and she's involved in a murder that occurs in Gilgal Gardens. And so, you know, that's sort of strong local color. And in some ways, I think it's not as successful as some of her earlier ones because Mormonism is more plays a more dominant but also a somewhat more awkward role. I think as Mormons become better known that it's easy to do a shorthand, colorful character, and people get an image or get an idea, and but you don't have to spend a lot of time developing it. I frankly think that the Peter Barth fiction, the conspiracy fiction, the Mormons are out to rule the world and have secret organizations to do it with, is pretty boring, maybe because it's been done for 150 years. But I also think that Paul's fiction is in a category of crime writers who are writing from a religious consciousness, and that's different. It's not just local color, it's not just an ornament on the fictional tree, but it is the tree, and that's, as a religious person, I find serious treatments of theological subjects to be endlessly fascinating, especially when they're done with verve and wit and cleverness, and there's that sort of zing at the end that just won't go away. So that's I hope that there are more people, more writers out there who are exploring this genre from a religious center, and developing that that concept in developing these religious ideas in other ways. I think it's a logical marriage because, you know, if you look at the classic causes for crime, ambition, greed, lust, all of them exist in the religious context. Mormons are wonderful, both as victims and as perpetrators of crime, and there's a special there's a special affection I have for having murder in the family, so to speak, within the religious community.
If you go to the Bibles for writing murder mysteries, and there are more Bibles than there are murder mysteries, everybody has an idea how they should be written, and they all seem to come down basically to questions of motivation. Why does a person kill? And they kill for greed, they kill for love, they kill for fear. And if you push it much harder than that, you don't find very many reasons beyond that. Well, it seemed to me that the Mormon community provides a fourth one of those because it suggests the possibility of murder for passion. But it's not a passion for a person, it's a passion for an idea. At the risk of boring you all to death, it is a purely platonic love affair between persons who love something so much it pulls them together. And when you love that thing so much, the church or God or whatever it might be, your reaction to that, your response to it, is a passionate response that is not easily affected by human beings or ultimately by human life. You know, it's the difference between an army shooting and an individual shooting. Armies shoot because of a passionate belief in something the group believes in. And it is not, we don't call it murder because it's not the individualized passion. And I think what Mormonism does, you could do the same thing in Reformed Judaism or some kind of Orthodox Catholicism. But Mormonism, in all of its branches, certainly in our particular group, is so ripe for for the creation of individuals whose passion we have given birth to, but whose passion we can't match in the way we treat them or the way we act. And so I think that that makes it at least a heuristic tool for talking about. Besides that, it is just fun. I'm sorry, but it is fun to figure out ways to kill off the people you don't like.
Let me go ahead and call him.
Yeah, you speak loud enough or something.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, you were asking why Mormons are involved in these murders and so forth, and I think that contextually there's an issue of power or authority, and that can lead to dominance and power struggle for murder. I think that the church has had secret elements to it, and anytime you have something that others don't know about, that brings an element of intrigue and so forth into the context of a murder case and so forth. And I think that the issue of polygamy was that this is some experience that most people in society have not experienced, and so it is a wanderlust that they have of what must be intriguing about this type of lifestyle and so forth that must generate all sorts of fascinating things, including such things as murder. And so those were a couple of the things that I thought of when you raised that issue.
Yeah, I think those are good points. Yes, ma'am.
Born and raised in the Mormon church, but left it and moved to California, came back and was visiting with a high school friend, and she said she was having some trouble with her son. I said, what's the problem? She said, the bishop, he didn't go to his next priesthood because the bishop announced to the whole congregation that he was masturbating. And I said, he what? He said, he's masturbating to the whole congregation? She said, no. He said he had a little problem. But what else could it be? And I said it could be drugs, it could be sex. And she said, our kids don't do that. At which point I thought, there's someone who should be murdered.
Thank you.
Yeah, being the only other person who has read your manuscript, Levina and I are duking it out as to who's your biggest fan. One of the things that drew me to Signature Books was the fact that I have a passion for Mormon history and theology and so forth, and it wasn't Signature's fiction that drew me to Signature. But about 7 years ago, I read a book called A Book to Die, and having worked in the book business and the bookstores and so forth, by John Dunning, it was one of those books that really spoke to me and the people that I knew, and it's something that was very familiar to me. And I had always spoken about a murder mystery around a Mormon bookstore. I thought that that would be a very, very cool thing. And then when I saw your manuscript sitting on my desk, I thought, oh, great, another artsy, feel-good novel. And as I read it, I found myself pacing around the room going, I can't believe a murder mystery around Mormon, a Mormon theme and Mormon archives and so forth. It was exactly the thing that I had hoped that to see. I was very excited about your book, and I think people would just be tickled when they have an opportunity to read it. One of the reasons why I kind of got after you about Rocco Porterfield is because the book is so wonderful that I found the name to be a distraction from the beauty of the book. But my question really is how many guys in the archive can you kill off? How many aren't there?
You've got an endless list of candidates, don't you?
I don't kill off anybody else in the archives, and we replace them with somebody not nearly as good as Ron, so you can certainly, immediately you feel sorry for us because of that. No, they move from item to item. My first thought was there ought to be one for each of the columns. And then since the 70s don't do anything, I couldn't figure out what to do for them. But That's just in-group joke. But I move them from office to office. The second one takes place during...
Tell them the setting.
During the sacrament service. One of the people is taking the sacraments murdered. And it took us a long time to figure out how to do that, but we got it. We got them done. And the third takes place in the financial office, the accounting office, which is easy to do there. I mean, that's a good question. If we do one about Grayson, we have a deal we could kill off there and work it into that whole thing. You know, I'm again, this was about the naming. When I was growing up, it used to seem to me that it was, you know, I always wanted to write. Since I was big enough to move, I wanted to write. And one of the things I like to do is think up names for characters. But thinking up names for characters is very hard, because people have names that reflect, I don't know how your parents know this ahead of time, but they seem to know something, or at least you're so much like them or something, but people's names have an incredible affinity to them. And to call a murderer Billy Bob just doesn't work. I mean, you got to have a good murdering name for a murderer. You don't want a lady love with a weird name like Barbie doll or Trishy or something like that. I mean, who wants to be in love with somebody named Trishy? Anybody named Trishy in the room? Okay. So I guess, you know, the difficulty often is coming up with a name that is not the name of someone you know, which is a very unwise thing to do. They always take it wrong. And a historical name which you think will help convey the message, but I think you're very right, is too much here. I used the name Luffman in one of the books, and it wasn't until after I used the name that it dawned on me we have an apostle by that name. Knowing him, I think he'll just laugh, but we may have to change that too.
What, Donald Osmond?
Yeah. Yeah.
I have one last question, and then we'll break. Just about the name, did you purposely pick a name that would have, you know, the same letter at the beginning of each name? Tomb Taggart, sort of like other heroes, Clark Kent, Sam Spade, that sort of tradition in both comic books and just hero fiction.
And how about the pun on tomb?
Years ago, I was in Edinburgh one time at a conference, a philosophical conference, and somebody got up and talked for about 20 minutes about the work of a man named Martin Keane. And when the guy sat down, the man in the back stood up and said, "Thank you, I wanted all those years what I meant." You know, it was Martin Keane, and he didn't recognize himself. You guys are writing too much in this. Tomb Taggart is the name of the farm we used to have in Lamont. I lived on a farm, and it's named after the Campbellite Scottish clan thing, which says Tomb Taggart, which means Kingdom of Patches. So it's strictly a name I always loved, and I like the reference Kingdom of Patches. It wasn't until I got among literary folks that I learned that I had done all these weird things.
Thank you for coming.